Help from Zoom. So this time we're entering in through the Western Gate. And I would say we're entering into the realm which to some extent represents the highest ideal of any spiritual tradition, the highest value, the highest ideal, which in a word for me is love. And in the Western realm, we encounter Amitabha, the Red Buddha. And there he is in all his red splendor, begging bowl in hand, in meditation posture. And his hands adopt the mudra of meditation. So thumbs just touching. So I'll say a bit more about the associations with Amitabha in terms of the image in due course. But I want to start, as I have done before, looking at the particular wisdom associated with Amitabha. And it is the wisdom of discrimination. So what's the wisdom of discrimination then? Let's approach it again, once again, through the constant of mind, that process of mind. So we've been through contact and feeling tone, and what happens after we experience the pleasure, displeasure, neutral feeling is we immediately interpret, we recognize some familiarity, some pattern in the sensation that we've experienced, and we put a label on it. So it's like recognition, interpretation of the sense experience. So it's kind of just putting flesh on the very raw bones of sensation. But there's more actually to interpretation than that. Obviously, there's a complexity also beyond just the bare putting a label on something. We also have a whole set of views and opinions and biases and prejudices with which we come to the perception. So it's like a complex set of interpretations. And these bring in a personal bias to our experience, our interpretation, our recognition, all the memories, all our own previous experiences, whether positive or negative, joyful or traumatic. There's kind of this, if you like, we bring ourselves to it. There's this egoistic distortion. So we don't see things just as they are. There's a whole layer of baggage we bring, which tends to be centered around our own interests. So we see what we see through the glasses of our own self-interest. But that's the unenlightened mind. But with liberation, that interpretation is transformed into the wisdom of discrimination. A way of describing the wisdom of discrimination is it's an appreciative awareness, a supremely appreciative awareness, without any of the distortion. We see what's what, without any of the baggage. And in particular, there's an emphasis on the fact that we perceive the uniqueness of whatever it is, whatever object is in front of us, whether it's a person or another thing. We experience a particularity, the distinctive characteristics of the object, the individuality. We see it and we appreciate it. We experience a sense of that richness of the world full of unique beings. We experience the diversity. So yesterday we were looking at the wisdom of equality, Ratnasambhava, and that was focusing on unity and diversity, but the wisdom of discrimination, Amitabha's wisdom, is focusing on diversity within the unity. So again, it's like different facets of the jewel of the enlightened mind. And this wisdom perfectly complements the wisdom of equality. So the wisdom of equality was not one of uniformity, kind of a boring level, this level ground, but yeah, or without feature. Once you see it in the life of the wisdom of discrimination, which emphasizes and appreciates the unique beauty of every being. Another way of talking about this supremely appreciative awareness, it's a bit of an awkward term, is simply love, even unconditional love. That profound affinity and empathy that we have a capacity for, without any sense of utility, you know, without any sense of wanting advantage, without any sense of exchange. Okay, I'll give you love and attention if you give me, well, love and attention and whatever else. So it's not conditioned on an exchange. It's just this outflow. Unconditional outflow, because the intrinsic value of whatever it is you love is appreciated, is there in view. All the unique qualities you recognize, you appreciate, and you love. And this unconditional love is of the unconditioned mind is non-dual. So it's that there's not a sense of I'm loving you. There's a sense of just unity. There's no need for this dualism. But there's no conceptualizing, and this as we've been talking about conceptualizing, if you like, brings in the dualism and the separation. There's no sense of self and other, and therefore, you know, there's no sense of exclusive attachment involved. It's when there's a self and another, and I need to hold on to that other, that exclusive attachment comes in, and possessiveness. So it's in this sense, it's a very pure, unconditional loving. So this is really largely what Amitabha is about for me, really. He symbolizes passionate attraction. A fascination, an intensity of emotion, as we associate with passionate attraction. The word we use most often in Buddhism, of course, to describe this love, our loving kindness, because love is problematic. The word love, you know, it can mean so many things. I love ice cream. I love chess. I love my partner. We use it in so many different ways. Whereas Buddhism tries to be more particular, more specific around this word, and uses the word metta is the Pali word, often translated as loving kindness, which is described as an ardent desire for the well-being of oneself and others. So it's an ardent desire. So it's not something tame. You know, it's some people think that only the more aggressive emotions like anger or hatred or jealousy, that they're the intense emotions. But there's a real sense that love, metta, loving kindness, it can be intense. It's described in the Buddhist literature as it burns, it shines, it blazes forth. And sometimes it's described, certainly in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, it's described in terms of a mother's love. As a mother loves her child, her only child, so long as she breathes, so may I offer unto all beings an all-embracing heart. This intensity of emotion is expressed also through some of the other symbols associated with Amitabha. So his element is fire, just as earth was Ratnasambhava's element. Fire is the element of Amitabha. And we talk about the fire of passionate engagement, the fire of passion. His color consistently then is consistent with that is ruby red, the color of blood, color of life, if you like, the color of intense emotion when we blush, when we have that rush of emotion. So the emphasis with Amitabha is very much heart engagement, harnessing emotional engagement behind our spiritual path. So devotion to Amitabha is a big thing within some Buddhist traditions. Indeed, it's actually central to the tradition, to the Buddhist, and central to the teaching and central to the practice. So you have the Pure Land traditions, and I don't know what the proportion is, but I think a significant proportion of the world's population of Buddhists would describe themselves as Pure Land Buddhists. There's a whole mythology associated with Pure Land Buddhism. You have, just as you had Abhorati associated with Akshobhya, you have a Pure Land called Sukhavati associated with Amitabha. So it's this imaginal symbolic realm. And there's a story around how Amitabha came into his realm of Sukhavati. His name in a previous existence was Dhammakara. And Dhammakara is a profoundly assiduous practitioner of the Dharma. And at one point, after many eons of practice, he makes a vow. He says that may all who recite my name be reborn in the Pure Land, in my Pure Land. And if not, may I not attain enlightenment and enter the Pure Land. So he's making his entry into the Pure Land, his attainment of enlightenment, conditional on this possibility that if people recite his name, they will, by virtue of that act, enter his Pure Land. So this is the territory of myth and symbol again. But then he does. He is enlightenment. He enters the Pure Land. Therefore, his vow is effective. That's how it seemed. And his vow, if you like, is the most powerful force in the universe. That's my understanding of the Pure Land tradition. So there's a great emphasis then on reciting his mantra and his name. That his vow to help all beings is this universal force within the universe, and we tap into that through devotion to Amitabha. And Sukhavati, this his Pure Land is kind of, what is that about? Well, one way of looking at it is that if you look at some of the symbolism of Sukhavati, there are books on describing this imaginative realm, but there are jeweled rivers and the birds, everything, the birds, all the beings in this land teach the Dharma effectively. You hear the Dharma in the birdsong. So effectively what it's saying is, in Sukhavati, the conditions for spiritual growth are ideal. We can, and therefore it becomes an ideal in itself, doesn't it? That if we can think, okay, how can I, in my own life, create ideal conditions for spiritual growth, through going on retreats, through daily meditation practice, through activity that benefits other people. If you like, it's a life's work setting up the conditions for spiritual growth. Sukhavati is entering Sukhavati is a life's work. Within this Pure Land tradition, there's an important point to make, and I think this is getting towards the heart of this kind of practice, this aspect of Buddhism, this approach to Buddhism that we're engaging with this weekend in the realm of the mandala of the five Buddhas. There's this sense of focusing on other power. So I'll say a bit more about other power, but I think to put other power in context, I need to focus a little bit, say a little bit about self-power, which is another approach, which maybe we're more familiar with, particularly in the West, the self-development approach. So there's a sense that the Buddha, our ideal, is over there, and I'm here, and I want to get from here to there. I want to attain the goal of Buddhahood. So it's a sense of wanting to close the gap between me and the Buddha, to resolve this separation, this dichotomy, to become one with the Buddha. And in the self-developmental approach, or the self-development approach, there's the emphasis is on effort. So I attain enlightenment through my own efforts. And that's really putting the conditions in place. So that's Sukhavati, that's developing, entering Sukhavati, where the conditions are perfect. So, you know, it's ethics, skillful karma, developing skillful habits, that purifies our mind and kind of creates this positive spiral, because then our mind, a purified mind, is able to be more skillful. And then, you know, that just reinforces the positive action, the positive skillful karma. But also, of course, there's the tradition of renunciation, detachment. But primarily, and let's focus on the practice of love and compassion. Buddhism is a training in responsiveness to the needs of others, going beyond that limited sense of self. And then that supports, that whole ethical practice supports a meditation, that deepening, broadening of our conscious awareness, attending to our own experience, getting to know ourselves more deeply, getting to see our habits, our habitual ways of behavior, so that we can work with them, but also breaking through, you know, refining our minds still further so that we can develop that wisdom, that seeing things the way they are. Because in a sense, we've honed the tool, we've sharpened the tool, we've focused the binoculars so that we can see, we can perceive the way things really are. And we can understand in that way, not just intellectually, but with our whole being, we can realize, we can embody the what we were talking about yesterday, shunyata, are the marks of existence, the lakshans. We can break through the delusion of a fixed self. Okay, so that's self-power. And maybe that's what we're more familiar with. And that's, you know, that's a very valid and strong approach to progressing on the spiritual path. But then the Pure Land tradition emphasizes this other power mode, our approach. And really, that this is familiar with you now, this deep into the weekend, because it's about personifying the ideal, using our imaginations. It's a way of seeing the imagination as a faculty for seeing. We personify the ideal as if it's something other, something out there. We visualize it as an archetypal Buddha, as a sublime being. You know, this presumably is all familiar by now. We have the five, the mandala of the five Buddhas. And the process is, if you like, is that we develop an emotional connection with these archetypal images. We invoke them through symbols, through the sort of rupas, the forms that we've seen already. We develop our emotional engagement through puja, through a whole range of symbols, through visualization practice, through invoking them, through repetition of the mantras. So we've done a bit of that this weekend, using the mantras associated with each of the five Buddhas. And the aim within the Pure Land tradition of repeating a mantra is to attain a state of egolessness. So again, identification with that ideal, that archetype. In the case of Amitabha, it's Amideva Hri, and we will be reciting that in the ritual. We'll be finishing today with a puja. So that the kind of aim, if you like, mythically, the aim is for the archetype, the ideal, to take us over, in a sense, to possess us. It's like the ideal plays out through us. That's the sort of direction we're going in. That's the sort of attitude. And so this approach of other power is, it can be described as the approach of self-surrender. So it's kind of, we personify the ideal, we engage our emotionally with it, and we surrender to this value, this ideal. But it's not, you know, it's easy to fall into to thinking, oh, you know, it's something out there. It's almost like a god. It's this other external being. But where does it come from? It's come from us. The ideal is our ideal. We're just using a skillful means, if you like, to work with ourselves. And for some people, this is very effective, this approach of self-surrender. So we develop through our imagination this image of the ideal with all the symbolism associated, and we surrender to the values that encapsulates. And then in the case of Amitabha, very much the ideal of love. So in a sense, it's about surrendering to metta, to loving kindness. And here the emphasis is in this Pure Land tradition, overwhelmingly, the emphasis is on this quality, this capacity of engaging the heart as well as the mind, which we call Shraddha. It's like this responsiveness to the Dharma, to the ideal. It's turning towards the ideal, recognizing it and really embracing it. So Shraddha, it can be translated as faith, but faith, because of the meaning of faith in other traditions, is often not helpful, because it's certainly not a blind faith. I'll say a little bit more about that. It's a confidence, trust is a better translation, really. And you could say that it comes out of when metta, when loving kindness, is directed towards the ideal. So it's an emotional response to the ideal. But it's not just an emotion, that's crucial. So Shraddha, just like metta is not just an emotion. You know, when we're working in the metta bhavana, it's not just, we're not just trying to develop an emotional, a feeling. There's also a sense of volition in there. You know, we're wishing well. So even if we don't have an emotional response to a person, we can wish them well. Even someone we find really difficult, even someone we don't like, we can wish them well. So there's this kind of active component of well-wishing. And that's an essential element of metta, you know, this ardent desire for the well-being of ourselves and another, that definition of metta. Well, it's only really an ardent desire if it actually goes and does something, if it has legs. You know, words and intentions are just not real metta, are they? Unless there's this dynamic aspect to metta, it's not real metta. Metta is active. Metta does things. It's effective. So it's not just emotion. So Shraddha has these other components. It's got the cognitive component, the head component, that understands the reasonableness, the consistency of, for example, a teaching. So that there's that cognitive aspect, and also there's the volitional aspect, which is the legs aspect. You know, so the cognitive is the head, the affective is the heart, the emotional, and then very important is the volitional, the legs. And you know, you can slip into thinking, well, I'm not the faith type, I'm not the devotional type, or I'm not the faith type, just because you don't have this intense feeling or emotion in your day-to-day practice. But actually, Shraddha, faith, confidence, trust, is also about the cognitive and the active, the legs part. So if you're getting up every morning and meditating, if you're doing your best to practice the precepts, if you're being kind and your intentions are in the right place, if you're studying all of these factors, they are that volitional, that's actually doing it. They're the legs. And that's just as much an aspect of Shraddha, of faith, of trust, confidence, as the emotional, the affective. So, as I say, in the Pure Land tradition, the emphasis is on Shraddha, or trust, faith, confidence. And the aim here, again, yes, there's this sense that the Buddha's out there and I'm here. But we're closing the distance. It's just the approach is slightly different emphasis. We're closing the distance between ourselves and the ideal through gradually engaging emotionally with this personification of the ideal and gradually identifying with the ideal. So we're dissolving the distance through identification. There's this sense that what your mind dwells on grows. So we're just making use of psychological facts, really, to transcend the distance and the difference between the external and the internal. What we've created initially through imagination as an external, we identify with it and dissolve that dichotomy between Buddha and me. We merge. Okay, other associations with the with Amitabha, we have his meditation posture. So he's in the posture of meditation. That's such a central image of or within the Buddhist tradition. There's a solidity to this posture, isn't it? There's kind of immovable. It certainly for me evokes a stability when I sit in meditation posture. That you could even describe his posture, I've heard it beautifully described as having an oceanic quality, so that there are unfathomable depths to the love of Amitabha. And his hands again are in dhyana, what's called dhyana mudra, so that meditation mudra with the thumbs just lightly touching. There's a real sense of it's a relaxed posture. So to have the thumbs just lightly touching, you need to make some effort, but just enough to have them just touching, because you don't want to put too much pressure on, or it just wouldn't be comfortable. You couldn't sustain it through the practice. But it just epitomizes or embodies this sense that meditation is about right effort, getting the balance right. Not too much effort, but enough effort to keep the practice, hold the practice. So it's about balance, the balanced effort. And then you have the begging bowl. In the days of early Buddhism, the monks stood with a begging bowl in the marketplaces or going around from house to house without actually asking for food. There was a sense they just stood there and they accepted whatever they got without grasping. They had an attitude of receptivity and openness. So again, they're the sorts of qualities that this image is symbolizing. We see the Buddha sat on this, it's more pink than red, isn't it? But a red, traditionally it's a red lotus. And that again, the lotus is a symbol. So we had the Vajra associated with Akshobhya, and we had the jewel associated with Ratnasambhava, and the lotus is very much associated with Amitabha, which it's a very rich symbol, the lotus. It represents spiritual growth, a sense that, you know, the lotus, what the lotus grows from the mud, reaches the surface of the water, and then unfolds. So it's like a beautiful flower emerges from the mud, and it takes time. You know, you can't force the lotus to open. You know yourself. You know, you just with gardening, with growing flowers, it takes patience. The flower has its own time. It has to unfold without being hurried. all we can do is provide the conditions again. You know, we can provide the water, we can provide, make sure it gets enough sunlight, that the soil is fertilized. We can't force these things. And this, it's the same with our own spiritual growth. We have to allow it to unfold just like the lotus. So the lotus, like any flower, also is an emblem of gentleness. And that, for me, this is the key feature of Amitabha, really, a sense of gentleness. And that's also there in the sense that he's the Buddha in the West. At the time in the West, of course, you have the sunset. And the sunset is quite a magical time, isn't it? It's when the sun, which might have been kind of blazing through the day, and you know, you can't look at it during the day. When it comes to sunset, you can look at it. It's approachable, even inviting. It's gentle again. There's an easy warmth about it. There's none of that intense heat coming from it, and it's compelling. There's a beauty about I meant to show an image of my time in Uttaraloka. I had a 3-month retreat in Uttaraloka, and virtually every night we had these amazing sunsets that you would just stand there in awe of this constantly changing, beautiful red display of sky. There's also a sense that, you know, it's coming to the close of day. You know, the busyness of the day is over. It's time maybe just to become a bit more interior. So again, the meditative posture of Amitabha reflects this. Time to withdraw from the senses and perhaps come into contact with our inner processes, our subconscious processes. Just as the sunset in the West, certainly in Ireland or in Wales, you see the sun as the sunset descending into the sea. So a sense that for me, that particular image of the sun setting in the sea is one of descent into the depths, into the subconscious mind. So through meditation, that's one of the functions of meditation, to allow, you know, what needs to arise from the subconscious mind to do its thing. Okay. So that's there is more to the image of Amitabha, but let's leave it there. And that's plenty to be going on with. Let us break up into groups. I'd encourage you to focus on, you know, where is the passion in your practice? What really turns your practice on as a possible theme for the groups?